Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be having a very frank and surprisingly uplifting conversation with a mortician who will be talking about the science of embalming and reconstructive surgery after traumatic deaths. I know, it's heavy, but actually it is really, really interesting. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. First up, though, it's time to look back at the week's breaking stories from the world of science. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from Research Ireland, Dr. Ruth Freeman. Our first story has to do with exoplanets, Shane.
Yes, absolutely. So when I was a kid, there were 9 planets, and that was reduced to 8. And in the time since, we've discovered thousands of planets are orbiting other stars, exoplanets. And we are, of course, very interested to know what's going on those and if any might harbour life. Are they in the so-called Goldilocks zone? And the basic way we do it is we use telescopes to look for them. And that's hard because there are hundreds of millions of stars in our Milky Way. And so where do you look? Enter AI and the power of prediction. So scientists working in Bern in Switzerland have used machine learning on solar systems where they know whether there are planets or not to train an artificial intelligence, an AI, to predict then where there may be habitable planets in other solar systems. Hmm. And so what they did was they used known data. They trained the machine learning algorithm, and then they tested it with another data set that they also had kind of known outcomes for, and they found that it was 99% accurate, which is pretty good, right? Mm. So that the, you know, any artificial intelligence is worth its salt if it's probabilistic in a good way. In other words, when you write into an AI, you know, a question, whether the answer is trustworthy or not.
Yeah.
Because it's just doing it based on probability, but you have to know whether it's right or not. Mm. So that's what they're doing here. And 99% accuracy is great, you know, because now we have 44 Earth-like planets in the Milky Way, according to this this prediction. And they're the places that astronomers with telescopes are going to start looking at first.
So what's really interesting about this is we don't know, or do we know, how it is identified these specific planets? Because with when you train a model, you basically show it lots of images of something and you say there's a planet here, there's a planet here, there's a planet here. And then eventually it figures out the things that make a star likely to have planets. Do we know what it's seeing in that that imagery that tells it, oh, there's a high likelihood of there being a planet here?
Yeah, so it's looking at the type of star, it's looking at where it is, it's looking at all the constituent components of those various systems. And then based on a mix of all of these different components, they're able to make some degree of prediction as to whether there is an Earth-like planet in that solar system or not.
That doesn't seem like it's enough information to be able to get that sort of...
I was surprised at it too, but yeah, it is incredible that they're able to tell, you know, how many rocky planets there might be, whether those rocky planets are close enough to a star for there to be liquid water on the surface, and whether they have other things like, you know, that would be indicative of you know, Earth-like status.
And we know that the model works because they tested it on known stars and their planets.
So they tested it with a bunch of things and they said, okay, now every time you see this, there's going to be a planet. So we're going to teach you now first. And then they said, okay, here's an unknown set to you. We know the answer. We're not going to tell you. You tell us which ones are right or not. And they got 99% of those right. And that's pretty good.
A rare good use of AI.
Yeah, when it comes to this and it comes to looking for medicines, you know, it's quickening the scientific process. The cost is whether it'll kill us all in the meantime, assuming massive amounts of energy. But who knows? We have other planets to go to.
You're quite right. Ruth, our second story is also space related, and it has to do with... It's not really a news story. It's not a paper, but it was an interesting theory that I haven't heard before about how we might find a way to live on Mars.
Yeah, my kids have a book, and in it, it's about a kid who builds a catapult and sends a big ball of ice cream to turn the sun off. And this seems about as sort of realistic as that. So it is an abstract. It's called Energy Problems of Terraforming Mars by researcher Leszek Czochowski, and it was presented at the 56th Lunar and Planetary Science conference. And as you say, it is a theoretical paper. But the idea is, when we look at Mars, obviously a lot of people talk about maybe Mars is a place that could be habitable for humans, but at the moment there is no liquid water, it has a very thin atmosphere, it's very, very cold. So the idea in this paper is, what if we could go out to the Kuiper Belt, what Shane was just talking about, the place where Pluto we used to think was a planet, but there's lots of icy objects out there beyond Neptune. What if we could go out there and harness some asteroids and bring them back to Mars and fling them at the planet?
No.
Would this bring liquid water and gases to Mars, particularly CO2? Could we start to kick off a greenhouse effect that would then eventually support life and create a habitable atmosphere? So that's the idea. I mean, the paper of the title of the paper is very timely, because the energy problems, I mean, just like AI, they worked out that even to do this once, if it was possible, would be centuries of energy usage.
Right.
So I think it was 25,000 years of current human energy consumption would be needed to bring one asteroid back. And that's before you even start to think about the time, the complexity.
But has he done that? Because I mean, I do think it's always interesting to hear about crazy ideas if they've been explored. I mean, it sounds like a crazy idea, but has he actually explored how we might do something like that and the effect it would have on Mars?
So I think what the researchers have done here is theoretically look to see, you know, they've done the maths to see, like, would this be possible? And I suppose they're saying technically yes. I mean, if we had the technology to get out to the Kuiper Belt, to bring something back and then to fling it at the planet, you know, would it make a difference? And I suppose asteroid strikes have made a difference in the past to planets. You know, we've talked about whether they've been part of, you know, terraforming this planet here. And I suppose, you know, back in 2022, we did have the NASA mission where we showed we could nudge an asteroid. So this idea that we have technology that can go into space and nudge an asteroid in a direction is there. And you're right. Look, this kind of big thinking is interesting, even if it's totally unfeasible. It's interesting to think about. And look, as I think with many of these stories about living on Mars, really, where it takes us is, let's look after the Earth.
Yeah. But I suppose by doing the mathematics, it might give us a little bit of an insight as to how, as you say, how other planets are terraformed and how some of these exoplanets that Shane's talking about, how they may end up with the water and gases.
The big problem with Mars, of course, is its core is cold. So it doesn't have a dynamic magnetic shield like we do. So, like, that's why it most likely ended up becoming a dead planet.
Yeah.
So,
all right, our third story is not to do with space. It's to do with bats.
Yeah. Have you ever been at a cocktail party where it's hard to understand conversation because there's a lot of background noise, Jonathan?
Increasingly as I age.
Yeah. Well, bats have this problem too. And so when bats are coming in and out of their homes at dusk, they all tend to go at the same time. And there was a scientist working in Israel who noticed that there was upwards of 2,000 bats per minute entering a cave. They're all coming home. And the scientist wondered, well, they use echolocation to feel their way around, to see effectively using sound, and the sound bounces off things and it tells them where things are. And they said, that's fine if everything's stationary, but what happens if you're a bat coming in with 1,999 other bats, all of which are moving? How do you figure out where everything is and avoid collisions? And so this is what this scientist is trying to figure out. And being a, you know, I love this story because what they thought about doing first was just going in and putting down microphones and trying to figure it out. They realized they weren't able to get good data. They put little microphones on 96 bats, 4 microphones per bat, and they traveled them and they built a model. And they're able to understand now how the bats relate to one another and how they're able to distinguish signal from noise. And what they learned was that in echolocation, there's a huge amount of redundancy. So there's a lot of noise that's made, it's repeated, and it's done, they think, because the bats know that in certain circumstances, there's going to be a lot of crosstalk. And so they need the clear signal to be repeated and to be strong so they can figure out where they are relative to other moving objects. And that's what we do too when we're at cocktail parties or anywhere where there's a lot of background noise. We listen for signals that are repeated and we're able to pull them out more efficiently. It's now thought that this is why animals in the wild, like birds or monkeys, will make repeated noises, so that they want to make sure that the animals that need to hear them will hear the repeated thing, so they'll get it eventually, effectively.
Right. And so when these bats are going in and out, they are continuously making noise, and that allows them to avoid in very close quarters a collision with 1,999 other
exactly.
bats.
Exactly. And so what they do is they actually end up using signals from their neighbours, in particular the one in front of them. So if there's a bat right in front of you and it's sending out chirps for echolocation, and you know that bat signal is good for you as well. So they're able to discern the kind of the things that are quite close to them that matter greatly, and the things that are a little bit further away that matter less. And this is all to do with the repeat rate and how the various mixes of all these echolocated sounds work in their brains. These tiny little things that weigh 40 grams are able to figure that out.
And can spot like a mosquito or a fly 2 kilometers away. It's, their anatomy is absolutely incredible.
Isn't it incredible?
Yeah. Yeah. Our final story, Ruth, has to do with, I think, probably my favourite bird after the bullfinch, crows.
I know, and crows, I mean, it's hard not to like them because they kind of are the brainiacs of the feathered world. They're incredibly smart, and we already know that they have really incredible mental capacity. They can recognise faces, they can use tools, they can store tools to use them later, they can look at another crow and by what they're doing know maybe where they've hidden food and find it. So they're very, very smart. Mm. But this is new research that adds another layer to what we know about corvid intelligence or crow intelligence. It's from the University of Tübingen in Germany, and it was published in Science Advances this week. And the researchers there trained two carrion crows to look at shapes on a touchscreen. So they showed them 6 shapes in 2 rows, and they trained them to pick the odd one out. And if they correctly picked the odd one out, they got a treat. And what was interesting about these shapes is this was about assessing whether the birds could pick up geometry and symmetry. So kind of fundamental principles in maths. So, you know, some shapes have kind of rotational symmetry. Imagine like a starfish, when you turn it around, it's the same. Or a butterfly, you fold it in half, it has that kind of mirror symmetry, or just a square or a circle. So they train the birds to kind of pick the odd one out. So one of the shapes didn't have the same geometric properties as the others. So they trained them on a set of shapes, and then they gave them shapes that they had never seen before. And they avoided common shapes like squares or straightforward rectangles. You know, they gave them more complex shapes.
Like the ones we would struggle with?
Well, potentially. I mean, some of them were quite complicated, sort of parallelograms and rhomboids and things that were sort of unusual shapes. You know, the crows were able to pick out the sort of rebel shape, the odd one out, far more than we would expect by chance. So what this research shows is that they do have this intelligence to pick out geometry. And one of the reasons why that's so interesting is because, I mean, we always associate that ability in humans with, you know, our sort of prefrontal cortex, those higher processing functions. And a crow's brain is completely different to ours, or you know, different to ours in structure. So this seems to be an example of convergent evolution, where the same skill has arisen, you know, through different evolutionary paths. So it's really interesting just to understand yet another facet of this crow intelligence.
Yeah, and on the face of it, I suppose, understanding shapes and how they fit in the world is probably useful, because even with a small amount of light or a small amount of information, you'd be able to identify this thing is a plant, this is whatever. But the idea that you can train a crow on symmetry and shapes and then transfer that idea of symmetry into a new test is absolutely insane.
Exactly. They're understanding the principle here, not just learning the shapes. And as you say, you can think about all sorts of reasons to know that in nature. If you're trying to build a nest, or if you're trying to identify a food that's safe to eat versus one that's not safe to eat. And again, while we think about crows as the brainy birds, I think in fact, when we go looking for these things in other species, whether they be birds or other species, we'll probably find them. It's just that we're not looking, or we don't know how to look in other species yet.
Mm. And of course, symmetry being interesting from a health point of view as well. Healthy animals help, and maybe healthy prey is more likely to be symmetry. Am I really stretching it? Maybe I am.
Who knows? Who
knows? God knows. But isn't it? I'm interested why your favorite bird is the bullfinch. I like them too. We have a pair that come to our garden. We call them Barry and Rita. Do you name your bullfinch?
No, I don't. Not yet. I'm still thinking about it. Oh, they're just beautiful birds. I think it's the rarity. You know, I only see this bullfinch in the back garden once every
month. And they pair for a long time. They're beautiful birds, absolutely.
The bird show coming up after this on News Talk. But for now, we'll say goodbye to Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Ruth Freeman. Thanks very much. fair warning, our next discussion will get into some graphic details because we're about to discuss the process and science of embalming with Glyn Tallon of Tallon Mortuary Specialists. He specialises in advanced reconstruction for traumatic deaths. Glyn, you're very welcome to the programme. It is always great to speak to someone who is so passionate about their work. Before we talk about the science of it, maybe very briefly, you might explain how someone finds themselves in the world that you're in, considering how difficult some people might imagine it is.
Yes, John, and thank you very much for having me on your show. My road into this job started going back many, many years ago. When I was a teenager, I became very, very interested in death care. And indeed, going back years ago, there was very, very little hygienic preparation done in our country, which is embalming.
Talk to me about the embalming process. When someone dies, let's not talk about traumatic deaths for the moment. If someone dies peacefully, why do they need to be embalmed? What is the biological process that happened that mean that we can't, that we need to preserve them in the process of embalming?
Okay, well, the three main principles of embalming is sanitation, preservation, and presentation. So from a sanitation point of view is when somebody passes away, and take, for instance, if they were of a palliative nature, their body will decay, like not the natural process will happen. So the embalming will delay this completely. So that means there is no rush for somebody to be buried. Bear in mind, Jonathan, we're on this planet for quite some time. Mm. Why should we be rushed off it?
Yeah, but in terms of the decay, how quickly does it happen? Because we turn around funerals quite quickly here in Ireland. How quickly does the body decay to a stage where it cannot be presented in an open casket?
In some situations, it will take a couple of days. It depends on how somebody passes away, the amount of drugs that has passed through their body from a medical point of view.
Right.
So there's many different factors. Like there's no two deaths could sometimes is not the same. So it depends on their diet. It depends on the amount of medication they've been taken. So there's many factors in the play.
When we talk about embalming as opposed to the presentation part, what exactly is happening there to preserve that body?
Well, the embalming process is the hygienic preparation of a decedent starts with the infusion of the injection that we would give of an arterial solution. The solution will come in and replace the blood in the body. So that preserves the tissue and organs.
Right. Okay. So that where the blood would normally proliferate in the blood vessels, that blood begins to decay and pool, causing unsightly blotches and decay of the tissue. This fluid that you inject basically prevents that from happening, sort of fixes it. Is that right?
Yes. What happens is this is injected, this is infused in the arterial system of the body, and the venous is taken out. So all the blood that you would see going through the veins on a lifelike person would be removed from the decedent. Mm. And the arterial solution would be placed in through the arteries of the body.
Okay. And that gives you time then for the other parts of your job.
Yes, indeed. So like we would be doing other, when the injection is going in, we would be working on other parts of the decedent, like we would be washing and grooming at the same time.
And so once you have cleansed the body, it's been embalmed, There seems to me, when I've been to a number of wakes open caskets, it seems like there is an extraordinary difference between the look of someone who has died and the look of someone who is just sleeping. And I've always found it quite difficult to keep my eyes on a dead body because of that reason, because I often find that the person doesn't look anywhere close to being alive, and they often don't look like they were only a few days ago. What is the cause for that waxy appearance that we see in dead bodies?
Well, it depends. It depends on the choice of fluids that the embalmer would use.
Right.
Personally speaking, I believe that somebody should look natural and lifelike, that they look as if they're asleep. It depends on the cosmetics that would be used. So again, there's many different factors. You can make somebody look a lot younger, or you could make somebody look like the stated age that they are. many different parameters around this.
I mean, in terms of, you know, when someone ages, obviously, or that when someone is unwell, they lose a lot of weight. When families come to you, do they give you images of what they would like their family member to look like in the casket? And how do you go about recreating that, please?
Yes. If a funeral director passes us a picture, take, for instance, if you go on RIP.ie, you will see lots of pictures of people up when they were living. Mm. So we would mimic these pictures. So this would give us great aids in regards to the complexion, the way their hair is done, the way their features are. So going by a picture would give us lots of avenues to go to get that desired appearance for the family.
Let's talk about the more tricky cases where there has been significant damage to the body. Can you take us through the various outcomes that lead it to be very difficult for you to work with an open casket and how you go about resolving those? Because, you know, some injuries, some diseases must be very disfiguring and very difficult to work back to that healthy individual that loved ones want to see in a casket.
Yes, indeed, Jonathan. We would come across this in close to a weekly basis. And there's lots of dynamics with this. Take, for instance, if somebody passes away with an RTC, which is a road traffic collision, there's lots of parameters that we have to work around. Like, they would fall under the medical legal umbrella, so they would be subject to an autopsy examination. Mm. So we have to link in with the mortuaries and the mortuary technicians to see when the decedent would be released. This could be maybe a day or 2 or 3 days after the decedent had passed away.
Right.
So obviously the family is very, very keen to get their loved one back. Having said that, if we're employed to do the reconstructive work in cases like this, we give the parameters to the family of the time frame that we're going to need. Mm. Now, when this is explained to a family in detail, unfortunately, it has to be the harsh reality because they want to know when they're going to get their loved one back.
Yeah.
We have to give a time frame. So within that time frame, we could sometimes work through the night on cases like this because, you know, we're trying to cut down the hours to get the decedent back to the family sooner. Very important factors that we have to work with. We would need pictures because if we're working with a lot of disfigurement due to the road traffic collision, you know, the picture is giving us a very, very good guide. We may need to speak to the family throughout while we're doing our work in regards to different features and parts, how somebody would look. Now, bear in mind, there's some people don't like getting pictures taken. So we come across these situations where somebody may not have been in a picture for the last 5, 7, 10 years.
Mm.
So this is where the creativity has to come in. And this is where the art really starts to shine through. So you're mimicking one side of the face to the other.
Right. So if you have one side of the face, you can reconstruct the other side. And I suppose that makes sense. Just if you've just joined us, we're speaking to Glyn Tallon from Tallon Mortuary Specialists. Just a fair warning, we are talking about reconstructive work after traumatic deaths. So when you have something as traumatic where the face is not fully intact, how on earth do you go about piecing that together from a scientific point of view? How do you technically put someone back together for an open casket?
Okay, well, we get back to the basics and we start from the known parts that we can identify. And we start rebuilding the bone from the known parts. So these little steps are very, very small steps that we're taking at a time. So this is why it has to be so intricate and detailed, because we get to portions of the face and you're looking at, if you're out a couple of millimetres, that changes completely what we're going to be passing back to the family. So we're looking very, very closely at placing all the bones back together. Sometimes the bone can be so badly damaged that we have to recreate them.
You recreate bones to reconstruct the structure of someone's face?
Yes, we would use prosthetics to use this. Yeah.
Wow. And what about the, you know, where the incisions meet together? I mean, is it easy to Because obviously, if God forbid I ever find myself in that situation where someone has had a traumatic death, looking at a face that has, you know, clear lines down the middle where that face has been cut apart, that would be very difficult. How do you go about putting skin back together in a way that doesn't seem like it's been sutured?
Yeah, for many years, embalmers would use different variances of wax to do this.
Wax.
We would blend the wax into the incision.
Mm.
Now, things has moved on a great deal since then, and we now use silicone.
Right.
Now, the silicone would be blended in, but it has to be also smoothed off, obviously, to marry into the tissue and also contoured. So take, for instance, on a male especially, if you had kind of a stubbly complexion or maybe not as smooth as complexion on your face, well, we have to make it look so it matches in with this. So if you see one part that's smooth and the other that isn't, well, we haven't got a good match there. So we need to blend it in.
Wow.
So you're looking at this is where things start to get very, very tedious. So we're looking at the blending and then cosmetics to go over this. And we're trying to keep things as opaque as possible, going by what colour we're looking at.
I presume the mindset of a mortician, as they're going into a project like that, as soon as they start working on it, it becomes, a technical task where they're focused very much on getting something correct. Because surely, from a survival point of view, you can't continuously be emotionally involved in the patients you're working with.
Yes, to an extent. Bear in mind, I have a family. There's people in my life I love, and like, you can't help but say to yourself, what if it was one of my family members? I'd want them looked after, and the person looking after them, I'd want them to care. So to a degree, you know, you'll always have that with you. Having said that, we're trying to get the best result we can for that family.
Mm.
So I wouldn't say you're emotionally involved, but like, you're 100% concentrating to get the best results for this family.
Okay, so we go through the process of embalming to preserve the tissue. And then if there's reconstructive work, you use various techniques to do that. And then there's the presentation part where you use makeup and presumably other materials to try and restore that person. Can you take us through that final part of presentation? How you do that? And is it just as simple as, putting on makeup on a living person, or are there other adaptations that you need to do to ensure this person looks as they were before they died?
Yeah, the finish is, you know, that's paramount. There is no doubt about it. Our finish on cases like this, Jonathan, take for instance, if we had somebody ready to be coffined, when I say coffined, to be placed in their coffin, and they would have their clothing, they would have been, they're close to be ready to be viewed, the finish could be taken about 3 to 4 hours.
Wow.
So the detailed work starts to go in then. So we would place the decedent in the coffin, and then we would do the finish, because we've got them in a certain position how the family is going to view them. We would possibly change the lights and bring them into our finishing area so the lighting is changed, so we don't have bright light shining on them. So we're going to see them exactly how the family is going to view them. So the finish is paramount.
What sort of understanding of the anatomy of the human body do you need to do this job, Glenn? Because it sounds like you're essentially doing the work of a reconstructive surgeon, and then some. Is there a big crossover? I mean, do you study human anatomy to become a advanced reconstruction specialist?
Yes, you know every bone in the body, you know every layer of tissue. That's part of your training as an embalmer. Your training is very, very in depth in these areas. There's no doubt about that.
Are there cases where you need to work with hair? Do you have like a stock of wigs and beards and so on, or how does that work?
Yes, we would keep a stock of natural hair. We would have multiple different colors. We would have, you name it, from a color point of view, we would have it and keep it in stock. Take, for instance, if we had somebody that underwent neurosurgery and unfortunately didn't pull through their operation or passed away in an intensive care unit and their hair could be shaved on one side of their head, we would replace that.
Of course, yeah. God, I never thought about all of the intricate steps that go into reconstructing a body for an open casket. Are there moments or are there cases that an open casket is impossible?
I don't believe this. We over the years, I'm doing this job close to three decades, Jonathan. I've never refused to do a case. We will take on any kind of reconstructive case. Like, we've often done cases that has been in the water for 42 days was the longest submerged decedent that we ever had. Wow. And we managed to make that deceased viewable for the family. Trauma cases in the way of RTCs, the road traffic collisions.
Or burns, of course, burn victims.
Same. Burn victims can be a little bit harder from the point of view that their tissue, depending on how much we would get of the deceased, can be the hard ones to deal with. Mm. But there's nothing that we won't do for a family.
I know that you are religious, and I'm wondering, does that help you in a way in your job, and does it shape how you view this? Because for me, I suppose I wonder, for why is it so important for people to see their loved one's face once they've died? Why do we as a culture need to see that face before they're buried? Maybe you might talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, my take on that is, Jonathan, when I go out the door in the morning, I say goodbye to my wife and give her a kiss, and my children too. Mm. When I come home in the evening, you get greeted by your children, your wife, or your family. So we say hello and goodbye. To say goodbye to somebody, you know that they're gone to work. What about the people that doesn't come home and you don't get to say goodbye to them? Mm. You know, when you think about that.
Yeah.
The penny kind of drops with a lot of people then. Well, you don't get to say goodbye to somebody that you love, and they end their way to work and their life is possibly taken.
It makes you think, doesn't it?
It does. It does indeed.
It's, I mean, I'm not a religious person, but I think it's fair to say it's God's work that you're doing. Glyn Tallon is with Tallon Mortuary Specialist. Thank you so much for coming on the program and telling us about your work.
Pleasure, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on your show.
Love to hear your thoughts on that and your experiences. If you've dealt with morticians, what is that like? I mean, do you remember it? Imagine you'd be in such a difficult space to have that conversation. Just seems to me to be so demanding. It must be so challenging. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Time to look back at some of your comments from last week. Neve Murray is a voluntary member of Tick Talk Ireland. And she says, Jonathan, I really enjoyed your recent interview on why mosquitoes taste before they bite. I found it so interesting. I'm wondering if you might consider covering a slightly similar topic, ticks and Lyme disease, in the Republic of Ireland on Future Proof. I feel it aligns well with your program's mission to explore science and health issues in a meaningful and accessible way. In particular, I think an episode could explore, as a loose suggestion, that specific pathogens carried by ticks in Ireland, not just Lyme's disease, but other co-infections, the testing process, Western blot and other diagnostic methods, and how effective they are at detecting Lyme diseases. We've never done Lyme disease. I kind of feel like it's a bit of a boogeyman thing, but actually, it's actually very serious. And we take our dog walking in the forest quite often, and it's not uncommon to find ticks on her fur. And of course, the damage and danger to humans is pretty serious as well. So I think we might take you up on that. That's Neve Murray. We might get an email out to you, Neve, and maybe you might come on and and tell us about it. Thanks very much for your email. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.